Royal Society. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. And I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Royal Society. I'm part of a working group that looked at a project on resilience to extreme weather last year and produced a report. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the outcomes from that report today. I'm also going to talk a little bit about how science can help support the disaster risk reduction process from what I called end to end, from the discussions about the international frameworks through to their implementation and monitoring. Okay, so first a word from my sponsors. The Royal Society is a fellowship of scientists that's been in existence since 1660. The slide I was given seems to suggest they're ending this year, but I can't think that's actually going to be the case. The important thing about the Society is that it does have a science policy arm, and it's from that science policy arm that a number of reports have been produced on things like cybersecurity and pesticides, and also, in this case, extreme weather. So, I think we've seen a number of presentations this afternoon which have emphasised the importance of science and disaster risk reduction. But there's two important drivers which I think make this particularly urgent. One sort of long-term and one short and medium-term. The long-term driver is that clearly the relationship between society and disasters will change as a result of climate change, biodiversity loss, growing exposure, and growing affluence. And that's going to put our future well-being increasingly at risk. The second and more short-term need is that while the international agreements that have happened in 2015 are extremely welcome, they are not currently, in my view, the purpose, design and implementation of those agreements is not currently aligned. Now, the drivers behind them are rather similar, so we shouldn't be surprised that serendipitously they will push in the same direction. But there may be some contradictions. And just as one simple and rather contrived example, Sustainable Development Goal 3.3 is about the reduction of malarial disease. Well, one way you can reduce malarial disease is you can drain wetlands and reduce river floodplains, which, of course, will increase flood risk. So unless we think very carefully about how the international frameworks we've constructed this year are put together, there's some danger of some very adverse effects as a result of unthinking implementation of them. So our report on resilience to extreme weather. Well, essentially, there were a number of conclusions which are relevant to science and the disaster risk reduction process. And I'm going to go through all of these in turn. The first is rather obvious, that evidence should be part of at the heart of the disaster risk reduction and the international frameworks we construct. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. Secondly, a thing that's easy to say but proves more tricky to implement is the fact that scientists need to provide evidence that's suitable for users' needs. And personally, as a scientist, I continually get this wrong. I have an assumption about what I think people want, and it's only when I come and talk to end users and people who are going to implement my research, I realise I needed to do things in a different way. A lot of the science we construct or undertake yields methods and technologies which are require a lot of infrastructure to implement. And that's problematic because a large proportion of the globe, that's not going to be possible. So we need to think very hard about producing science and technology that's suitable for available to everybody, either through open data agreements or by providing it in a form that people can actually use. We need to involve people who make and implement policy in the research process right from the very start. The co-production is incredibly important. And we need to also get behind our research funders and make sure they understand that they need to promote collaboration between the producers and users of knowledge. And there's a number of structural things in our research funders' operation that mitigate against that. And lastly, one of the most interesting and possibly controversial conclusions of the report was that we can harness the power of capital to make some of the required changes. And the idea here is that if companies reported their disaster risk on their balance sheets and it was reflected in their share prices, we could probably encourage more rapid change than any number of international frameworks or agreements. So let's have a look at those in turn. So the idea that evidence is at the basis of the international framework is very obvious. We want evidence-based policy and not policy-based evidence. One of the conclusions we came to in our report is that often, certainly for disaster risk reduction, we needed to integrate science and social science knowledge together. And I've got a good example of this here. So these are projections from global climate models of exposure to a particular natural hazard, in this case flooding. And these are the increase in exposure events by 2090, so end of 21st century, under two scenarios. On the left-hand side, this is the change in exposure if we just assume the 2010 population. And on the right-hand side, if we use the projections of population out to 2090 and include those in our calculations of increased exposure, we get a very different pattern. And more importantly, the conclusion that you draw is that in order to correctly forecast changing exposure, you need to take into account both physical processes, but also changing society and changing vulnerability. So that's a very obviously a very nice piece of evidence for producing international frameworks, but it's not a piece of evidence that's suitable for users' needs. Global climate models and global products aren't going to help somebody take a decision about their locale, and therefore you need to downscale that information to human scales. A good example here is a project at the University of Manchester called RESIN, which is to enhance the resilience of Europe's cities to extreme weather. And to be able to do the downscaling, you need to engage researchers and policymakers in this whole process. So, there's a missing image, which is rather unfortunate because it was rather a good one. The idea that that all countries need to have access to technology is a very obvious thing to say, but often there are multiple barriers to this. Often data is commercial. It may be available only in forms which are not accessible around the world. It may be the development of forecasting systems may be tied to export credits and not to the needs of the people who are actually going to be implementing those systems. What we had an example of here, let me see if I can come out I don't have the diagram even there, which is unfortunate. The image we had here was a 90-metre global map of flood risk areas, and which was created using rather complex computer modelling and some high-performance computing. The image here was a map of Africa at 90-metre resolution showing the areas of flood hazards. And it's the kind of map that's beyond the capability of many countries to produce currently. So at the University of Bristol, we've been developing this map through a startup company funded through commercial sources. But to make that geospatial data available, we've been working with Google's Crisis Response Unit in order to produce the results and make them available to everyone. So Google Crisis Response is a facility where if a disaster warning is issued and you're in that area and you do a Google search, a warning will pop up at the top of your search list telling you that you're in a crisis area. But to be able to do that targeting, clearly Google need information on the areas at risk. That's quite easy for an earthquake. Those areas are quite broad. Flooding, however, is all flooding is local, and therefore you need very high resolution maps in order to be able to produce targeted warnings and minimise the risk of false alarms. Involving users and policymakers in the research process is clearly also a really sensible idea. And when we came to look at that, it actually turned out my own university was the good example that the Royal Society picked out. In fact, there are two universities in Bristol, and both were really engaged with local policymakers in the production and construction of research projects. And lastly, research funders really need to encourage collaborations between producers and users of knowledge. So funding is one of the biggest problems that prevents collaborative research. The kind of metrics that funders use sometimes mitigate against funding interdisciplinary research proposals, and also double jeopardy reviewing, where you have to be excellent both in the impact aspects and also the science can mean that these proposals are more hard to fund than something that is a pure science proposal. But one good example in the UK is a project called Slowing the Flow, which brought together researchers from multiple universities and local people, funded by, in this case, by research councils, to come up with local solutions for mitigating flood risk in a particular area by slowing down flood waves as they move through a particular basin. And then the last point I was going to make was about fusing science and capital and the potential of that to lead to rapid change. So currently, companies don't reflect their disaster risk in their share price. And yet we know from events like the Bangkok flooding of 2011 that billions of dollars can be wiped off balance sheets because of unprepared for risks. So if there was a requirement to report that risk, and that was reflected in company values, I think that would lead very quickly to rapid change in attitudes about where to develop and where to invest. A good example here is something called the Solvency II regulations, which is an EU programme aimed at the insurance industry. And in this, insurance companies have to report their have to undertake a series of stress tests to prove that their balance sheets can withstand particular losses, including natural hazards losses. And that's driven significant change in that industry. So, science, as I said, needs to be involved in the end-to-end disaster risk reduction process, all the way through from the formulation of the agreements through their implementation and assessing whether they're working or not. To conclude then, the Royal Society's work on resilience to extreme weather has shown that science has a fundamental role to play in disaster risk reduction and informing policymakers. There's still a lot to do, and we still need to get better at learning from past mistakes and also successes. And there's important messages here too for funders and also companies about how they can both incentivise collaboration, assess their risks, and actually build that into the global capital system in order to effect rapid change. That's it. Thank you very much.